This is the audio lecture for section B4, and it's an introductory study to identity. Now, we could first of all note that human personal identity is a complex tapestry that involves aspects like self-image, self-esteem, how emotional the individual is, their beliefs and values, their dispositions, their commitments, as well as their family, personal history, ethnicity, and even a sense of city, state, and nation state may all have a bearing on personal identity. And all of this mixed together in this tapestry gives some reasonably well-established and healthy individuals who have a good sense of who they are, with some self-confidence, and they know where they belong. When there is not a sense of identity, then this woven tapestry will be problematic. It all has to do with answering the question, who am I? And of course, we can answer that very quickly by saying, I am this historical person, I've been this way for many years. And there's also a more complicated question in that you have changed and grown and matured and done so many different things that this sense of personal identity is ever changing, is ever developing. It's like a story unfolding with personal change in it. Now, I want to begin by looking at an example of how you get different personalities, and you might use the word analogously, identities in animals. And I've used the two orphan cats that we've managed to pick up from down the street. We have five orphans that we've picked up over the years, but the latest two were more or less left on the street by their owners, who went to work for a couple of years in India, and they supposedly left the cats in the care of their adolescent sons. And I think their idea of caring was to put a bowl of food out and forget about them. So gradually they migrated to a place where I think they had more a sense of home. And I can just compare and contrast the two personalities of these cats. They're white Burmans. It's the French national brand of cat. First one is Mocha. Now, Mocha is not a pretty looking cat. In fact, he reminds me of the face of the actor Mickey Rourke. It looks very pockmarked and tough and wizened. And from the second day that he actually arrived in our suburb and he escaped, Mocha came to our place and thought, ah, this is a good place to be. And apparently the texts on cats have said that a number of Burmans, they decide where they're going to belong. And apparently this cat did this right at the start. So I, of course, rang up, looked at his collar and found a phone number and was able to deliver him back home. The next day he was back again. And he continually kept coming back again and again, wanted to dominate the other cats here. And I did all sorts of things, like I'd chase him with a hose, I took him home every night for a few months, and I built plastic netting barriers to stop him from getting into our backyard where he would brawl with the other cats. Then after a while I just gave up because he so strongly identified here. Now his partner, or not his partner, might call it his brother cat, is Latte. Mocha's got a brown nose and Latte's got a light nose, so they call them after Mochas and Lattes. Anyway, Latte is not like Mocha. Mocha seems to have a very secure sense of who he is, where he belongs, and what people he's going to relate to. And these personal and human and house resources seem to give him a sense of who he is, and he's secure. He doesn't hide ever. He's very laid back. He approaches people and has a sense of nothing troubles him very much. Now, the other cat, Latte, is a very different personality. He seems to have a very insecure identity. When his owners left, he just roamed the streets and didn't identify with any particular place as a home. He just wandered from house to house and some people fed him. He looks very pretty and he's attractive and he goes to people when he's hungry, but otherwise he shuns people, he's scared of them, he's very skitty. When you do have him around, he will climb to the highest place in the room. Apparently insecure cats do this to get some sense of security. You can see in the actual text, it's a short summary of the characteristics of each and a video to show you a little about each of them. Now, I think that the behaviour of Latte is like a, well, you could diagnose it as perhaps insecure and uncertain in his identity. He's not sure who he is when he's called by name. He doesn't know who that is. Whereas all the other cats here, especially Mocha, when you mention their name, they know who that is and they turn and look at you and sometimes they come to you almost like a dog. So we were at a stage where Latte seemed to think, well, Mocha's on a good thing there. I perhaps should visit there a little bit more often in my travels. He's a bit like Marco Polo, went everywhere in the suburb and would spend a lot of time on the golf course. I noticed when I was down there once looking at some other issue, the golf course people said they often saw this cat wandering around there. But eventually he seemed to becoming more identified with this house and spent more and more time here. And it seemed that the human attention that we gave him and talking to him and paying attention to him, it was this sort of socialising that he seemed to have lacked. And he seemed to be coming around. He was less skittish, more friendly, didn't climb and hide in so many high places, seemed more comfortable on the ground. So I think you could draw an analogy from this when looking at humans to say that there's going to be some elements of personality that are genetically determined, about which people have no choice. They're the cards that they're given. And so it may well be that a significant part of the sense of personal identity is going to be genetically determined. And you then ask yourself, well, how much scope is there for change? And that depends on the individual. Often it has been my impression that people, indeed a lot of people, know what they need to do to change to become better people, but they just don't have the courage or the commitment to do it. So in the end, most people don't change very much. So what we'll be looking at then is that there are going to be some elements of personality that colour the individual's identity that are genetic and distinctive. And there are going to be some elements that can change to some extent. And what we would be hoping for is that somehow you can educate people with respect to identity. And we'd be looking into what does this mean. But certainly you would hope that educating their identity would be not about trying to impose some external identity on them, although some states and some people try to do this, some parents try to do that to make the child into a carbon copy of themselves, but it's in the way of resourcing, educating them to be able to think more about personal identity, about how it's developed and what are the factors that can enhance it as well as factors that might inhibit it or damage it, and how does it relate to the culture? Can the culture have a shaping influence, either healthy or unhealthy, on the development of identity? And I think you'll see right from the start that this is a little bit more concrete. It's a little bit more clearly psychological. It has more references. in our own experience and thinking than the more abstract idea of meaning. So I expect that these three sections will be easier to negotiate and will be perhaps a little bit more practical than the first three, but the two do go together very much. Identity is, in a sense, like the self-expression of the meanings that people have about themselves and about life. After considering that and perhaps looking at the pictures of the cats and what's happened in their more recent history, the next thing to do is to give your attention to an example that shows some of the complexities in the development of personal identity. And I'd like you to begin this by having a look in the text at the link that takes you to about a 15 to 20 minute video, and it's a documentary about what happened in 1939 when the Wehrmacht invaded Poland, starting World War II. After the Wehrmacht worked their way through Poland, the SS came along after them and kidnapped all of the babies and young children who they thought exhibited the true Nordic Germanic features, and they were stolen, taken from their parents, and adopted out to German couples back in Germany. And this is the story of one, and even though my editing of the old video was not so good, hopefully you can follow it through. It looks at one of these children. His name was Alojzy Twardecki, and he was aged four when he was kidnapped and taken to Germany. He was given to a family in Koblenz, and they became his second mother and his second father. And he narrates the story of what happened to him through all this process. And he tells you that he became a totally dedicated Nazi youth, Hitler youth, through the Hitlerjugend. And through a strange set of circumstances, he eventually found out that he actually had a Polish mother and father. Even though his mother was originally German, she lived all her life in Poland, she was a Polish German. He wouldn't believe it, the thought of being a Pole, like the Poles who swept the streets in Koblenz and who had newspapers wrapped around their feet because they didn't have shoes, who carried the coal. He was brought up, particularly through his education, to see these as less than human. So the idea of being Polish was particularly upsetting for him. But as you follow the story, you find that he eventually gets back to Poland, and then he gets caught there because the communist government won't let him go back to Germany. So he starts off as a Polish child. He then becomes a German child, a German adolescent. Then he gets caught in Poland for, I think, another 10 years before he ever gets back to Germany. And so he will tell the story of what this meant to his sense of identity. Did he start off Polish, then become German? Did he ever become Polish again? What happened to his German sense of identity? He ended up having four parents, two fathers and two mothers. What sort of a difference did this make? So you can see some very, very interesting questions are raised by having a look at the video. And in particular, I'd like you to note what is said about the role of schools, both in Germany and in Poland, in terms of educating his sense of identity. Did it make a difference? Now, after concluding that part of the study, the next section we want to have a look at briefly is about the nature and the psychological function of personal identity, and we'll work towards a definition or an interpretation of personal identity towards the end of the section that I hope will be useful for educational purposes. But first of all, I want to raise some questions about the way the word personal identity is used in contemporary discourse. Now, firstly, when the word is used, I always think that there must be an issue. Because often when identity is secure and settled, it's not a question, nobody will talk about it. And the same with a healthy individual. You don't get up each day and wonder who the hell you are. A healthy identity would need some sort of robustness that doesn't have to be fixed up, patched up and rehabilitated every day. So when the word's identity comes up, particularly with respect to institutional identity, my concern is always, who is anxious? Who is worried? Who's got the problem? What is the problem? And so that anxiety, that emotional dimension that sometimes drives a concern to use the word identity needs to be understood. Identity seems to be a very important term for the psychological development of individuals. So it's very prominent in psychology. It's also very important for social groups. People like Native Americans and Australian Aborigines would often, like the Jewish community, use the word identity as probably even more important than religion. You know, they will talk about Aboriginal identity, Jewish identity, and so on. Now, it may have a strong sense of ethnicity in it as well. So personal identity and institutional identity will also be all about the way you are perceived or the way you yourself see yourself as different from others, individuals and cultural groups. One of the concerns that and the anxieties that often drives the discussion of the term identity comes from ethnic groups and religious groups where in a very secularized multicultural situation they can feel that their distinctive ethnic and cultural identity or their distinctive religious identity is somehow being diluted or lost in the homogenization of popular culture. It could be that they sense children identifying more with elements in the local popular culture than with their own ethnic or national tradition or particularly with their own religion. And I think that one of these anxieties is particularly evident in the growing interest in the term Catholic identity of Catholic schools. And that's why I always have concern about its use because of the anxiety that drives it, and it may often tend to think that if we stress the word Catholic identity and do a lot to strengthen Catholic appearances that will solve the problem, and I think that that often doesn't. And this anxiety needs to be acknowledged because if educational action is driven by anxiety, it won't always be as helpful or as healthy as it might be. And this big issue is taken up in a whole section in section C10. So we won't say too much more about it until then. But what I would like to note quite early on is that my own experience in looking into this question of identity or the word identity for quite a number of years is that the sense of personal identity can be very helpful and useful for education. When it comes to institutional identity, whether it be a church or a club or a nation or an ethnic group, I think it is still important, but it's more prone to difficulties, to manipulation and problems, and I don't see it always as such a useful term as the term personal identity. Anyway, that remains to be seen and you can come to your own judgment on that in the light of what we cover across the unit. One of the other issues that arises and I've referred to it briefly already, is that young people may well now be using the popular culture, particularly the imaginations of life that are orchestrated through the various media, as a principal source of identity building materials, by contrast with the way in times past people drew more on their own family, their local community and their religious traditions as identity resources. And so it poses an interesting question for education. What will be the role of education in resourcing the identity development of young people, knowing that the school would be just one of a number of agencies and community reference points that would have some bearing on the development of identity? It's suggested in the text that people can develop their sense of personal identity through a complex interplay between five centres of influence, and these would be the popular culture, expressed particularly in the imaginations of life that are orchestrated and presented in the media, which show up lifestyle options and consumerism. Secondly, reference to a distinctive ethnic and/or religious heritage. Thirdly, a major reference point would be a national identification, the overall social and political contexts that host the component cultures. Fourthly, these are the internal drives and needs and resources, the interests, ambitions and personalities of the individuals themselves. And fifthly, the family group will be a significant reference point for identity development. And this then often gets displaced to a large extent by friendship groups in adolescence and other groups that the individuals participate in, all of which can make some contribution to personal identity, like sporting clubs, school, and so on. So the profile of an individual's personal identity is going to end up being a very complicated psychological mix of those five lots of resources and influences. And you see, I like this term resource for identity because it's not something you can necessarily impose, but if it is there as something that can be accessed by individuals in their personal and identity and spiritual development, then that will be very helpful. And I think right from the start, I would like to suggest that the idea of resourcing the identity development will be one of the roles that a school education might be able to contribute towards. For many people, a religious identity can be a very significant component of their overall personal identity. This is where a religious faith tradition can give individuals a sense of belonging to a community with a common faith that has a very long history. Religions have a lot of resources in spirituality and social structures that can guide people's lives, and this animates local religious communities and it can inspire individuals. But we also need to understand, particularly in our society today, that religious identity can also be a serious cause of problems, because you have to ask the question, what is an authentic and true religious identity? And we see this particularly in Islamic terrorists, where they will be claiming that is true Islam and other people will saying it is not. And so we need to actually scrutinize and evaluate religious identities and have some criteria for making judgments about how healthy and authentic they may be, particularly with respect to the situation of the foundation of the religion. So for Christianity, how would a Christian or a Catholic religious identity square up with the ideals of early Christianity. This way, you might end up being able to judge what is a healthy religious identity, and an unhealthy one would be one that, in the extreme, would promote violence, ethnic cleansing, sectarianism, suicide, killings, and so on. And it was interesting that back in the 90s, when they looked at all of the 160 civil conflicts that were going on in the world, in about two-thirds of these, religious identity was a recognisable component in the complex mixture of causes. And this has been the case throughout history. It's not to say that religious identity causes wars and fighting, but it may well be that people who get involved in fighting in wars will use religious identity as a sort of a justification for what they are doing. And we have that today in some religiously motivated terrorism. We had it in the Christian Crusades and so on. In World War I and World War II, you had both sides praying to the Christian God to be on their side in battle. So religious identity can be quite problematic. In the text, there are a couple of notes on what I mentioned earlier as the emotional anxiety that can be there in individuals and in cultural groups that trigger concern about identity. When coming towards thinking about what is a personal identity, it is always helpful to see that it will have components. It is never something simple. It always has parts. For example, there is the intentional identity that people will have in how they talk about who they think they are and what sort of a person they may be. And this may well not always be congruent with their implied identity. In other words, in reality, what sort of a person are they like? We could talk about the moral identity of individuals, referring to the beliefs and values and motives that inform their behaviour. Religious identity would refer to the extent to which individuals would draw on religious traditions to describe and live out their identity. It's the extent to which formal religion influences their lives. One of my concerns today is that a lot of people have like a Teflon identity. Nothing seems to stick, and they're always trying to put something in there to prop it up. And for others, there can be a sense of retail identity, where what they buy, where they go, what experiences they have bought by money are considered by them to offer some sense of identity. So the possibility of a retail identity. And this issue will be looked at more carefully in section 6, because I think one of the big problems for people today is that their identity is skewed and exploited by consumerism. The table in the text gives a useful summary of the different aspects or qualities of personal identity. A brief point about two of the principal functions of personal identity, and I've called these projective and defensive. Now, projective function of identity is the way in which the individual's sense of identity projects or displays the characteristics of the individual or group, if you're talking about group identity. It describes and it publicly announces the individual's identity, and it shows what the individual or the group stands for. Now, this is like the proactive, the positive, outgoing function of identity. At the same time, it also has a defensive function. That means it signals the characteristics of the individual that help protect the individual psychologically. The identity includes internal resources that the individual can fall back on in times of stress or trouble. It's what the literature describes as people's true metal or character. In other words, it's sometimes only in adversity that the real character or nature of people shows up in the way that they can survive and be noble and honest and true and decent through difficult times. The defensive or protective function of identity comes into play when individuals feel that they're under attack, whether they're humiliated or whether they're physically or psychologically attacked. You can think of people in the concentration camps in World War II, and you can go back to what was said in those quotations from Viktor Frankl in section one, where he said the people that had the internal resources, like the internal beliefs, commitments that define the structure of who they believe themselves to be, and this was all internal, and it was strongly appropriated. They were deeply committed to it, and it could not be shaken by the way they were humiliated, poorly treated, and even executed or murdered by their captors. Even when you are perhaps badly treated at work and your work is devalued, it can be very humiliating and cause a lot of depression. But if you really believe that what you've done is right and that you have been done wrong by the people in charge or whatever, then you're not damaged. You may need to leave the organisation, move on if you find, well, they don't really value you, but you yourself are not damaged as a person. If you are not really internally secure with strong defensive identity functions and things go wrong, it can lead to depression, suicide even. It was noted that when the Ansett Airlines finally went under, a number of people at different levels in the organisation committed suicide. They were so strongly identified with that company that when it went bust and when they felt they were betrayed by it all, they just gave up on life. It makes you wonder, should you be so dependent on your place of employment for a sense of self? I'd like you to read now the section on identity relationships with religion, where a few interesting preliminary ideas are brought up, because there is always naturally a concern of religious communities to hand on their sense of religious identity to the next generation. And this is now quite problematic because lots of young people feel they can get by without any religious identity, and they're not going to pay much attention to the beliefs, the values, the ritual, the spirituality of their religion in expressing and defining their own sense of who they are. So it's a problem. And then it raises questions about, well, what's the role of the school, the church school, the Catholic school, and of religious education in particular? Can it really influence the religious identity of people? If so, what are the possibilities and the limitations, and how can this be done in an ethically educational way? And what is a realistic expectation of what it can achieve? And so this is one of the things we will work towards. And the first thing that we really need to start with is some way of interpreting and defining personal identity that is going to be helpful for educators, so that it will give them some criteria for working out, well, what do we need to do to educate in identity? And in these sections, 4, 5, and 6, we're really looking into what is identity and how does it work and how does it develop? And then this is, in some sense, summarised and put together in section 7, which investigates, well, in the light of all the work we've done in those first 6 sections, what does it really mean to educate in identity and in meaning? If you hear meows in the background, that's our little friend Latte, who's still recovering. Now, in the definition of identity that we have found most useful for education, one of the things that we have tried to work into that definition is two things: that there's a sense of identity permanence that doesn't change, as well as the capacity to change and develop some aspects of personal identity. So that'd be the first thing that we'd want to have in a definition of identity. Secondly, you would want a definition that could give a sense that it can be reasonably stable with gradual modifications. For example, the self hypothesis, how we understand ourselves, needs to be relatively stable. If it at times it's not so stable and it's insecure, then we've got problems that need to be addressed. So with those hopes for a definition of our personal identity in mind, this is the one that's proposed. Personal identity can be conceptualized as a process in which individuals draw on both internal and external cultural resources for their self-understanding and self-expression. This understanding of identity implies a dynamic interplay between the internal personal resources and the external cultural elements. The externals are relevant to identify when they serve as reference points and resources for self-understanding and self-expression. That is, when they're functioning as cultural identity resources. There's a lot out there in the culture, and not all of it is internalized and taken in. But when it is, then you can identify it as cultural identity resources. This view also highlights the idea of integration of ideas, beliefs, values, images, these internal ones, along with the extent to which we might need external ones, like what sort of clothing, what sort of vehicle, what sort of house. And it's not that those things are insignificant, but as you will see, there is a possibility that too great a reliance on the externals can skew identity in an unhealthy direction. So you can see that there is also both process and content in identity. The process, the way things are assimilated and understood, and content, the ideas that are out there in family life, in heroes, heroines, peers, religion, school, art, work, lifestyle, leisure, television, social media, consumer products, all of those things can enter into some relationship with the internal elements, the needs, beliefs, values, ideals, emotions, moods, and so on, to fashion a type of internal clothing of the individuals through which they identify and understand their own characteristics as a person. And it also has to do with how they're going to draw on different elements of culture to express who they think they are. And that would be the choices made in where you go, where you live, how you live, your lifestyle, what you wear, how you consume. All of these things are or can be considered as expressions of personal identity through cultural elements. So from there we could propose that there's a natural key to understanding what a healthy personal identity is. And you could say that it's healthy when there's a harmonious balance between the internal and the external identity resources. This is making a value judgment, but that is part of the definition that's being proposed here. And it also suggests that the most important elements are the internal resources, like beliefs, values, and commitments. These are the things that give resilience, that have some robustness about them, that shouldn't change very quickly, whereas lots of the external things can. So the spiritual resources often will include religious elements, but not for everyone, are regarded as the inner directed, really key elements to a personal identity. But it would be a little unrealistic to think that people could be so spiritually strong and independent to rely, you know, almost exclusively on their own internal resources without having some stuff to lean on and to help express yourself. And this dependence on cultural resources for identity building parallels what we talked about in sections 1 and 2 about the way that cultural meanings inform the way the individual construct personal meaning. You can't really be a good human being by yourself, and you can't really develop a healthy personal identity by yourself. There always needs to be this interrelationship with cultural identity resources. Another element that I would suggest is important for a healthy identity is that it is mainly self-validated. That whatever the cultural resources that are used and assimilated for self-expression and so on, that it is the individual himself or herself who knows that this is what's appropriate. They're not dependent on, or too much, on being validated by others. In other words, they're not always trying to impress others or prove others or get the likes of others. And so that almost suggests that there could be difficulties with the social media and the way that the likes could be like a barometer of how healthy your identity is, at least the projected identity on Facebook and other media. But the point that I'm emphasising here is that a healthy identity is primarily self-validated from the individual, from within. And also another aspect of identity health is that it has a level of robustness and resilience to it, and it doesn't require a lot of energy for its maintenance. You don't have to keep stoking it up and adding to it and reviewing it every day. It's something that has a momentum and a security about it that it doesn't need to be constantly changed and reviewed if it's healthy. It's always open to change, but to be changing with the wind would be an indication, I think, of a relatively weak and insecure sense of identity. I think that this view of personal identity and identity health that I've just talked about is useful for the education and care of youth in a number of ways. Firstly, it readily allows for an educational role because education can help give young people access to the cultural resources to assist with their development of self-understanding and self-expression. Secondly, it's a useful construct for the interpretation of behaviour in the light of identity motivations. In other words, you can often understand why people are acting in a particular way because it's expressing an identity need. For example, why do people have particular clothes? Why do they have a particular lifestyle? Often it may well be that they're advertising something. They're trying to say, look at me, take notice, this is what I'm like. And it raises questions about why do people have tattoos and purple hair and so on. It may be for a sense of fun. It may be that some people just feel they need to be noticed all the time. The third value of this definition is it has a strong psychological focus, and it's related to other key constructs like self-esteem and self-knowledge. And it also is closely related to purpose and meaning in life. I think purpose and meaning is like the rational thinking components of identity, and when you turn it into how are those same ideas of meaning turned into expressing and understanding the self, then it's like identity. It's like two sides of the same coin. The fourth value for education is that this understanding of identity has significant links with social interactions and cultural identity resources. And often, because these are out there, they can be identified and evaluated. And even if people ignore them or are repelled by them, we need to understand what are the resources, the ideas, the myths, the stories that are in the culture that can have a shaping influence on people's thinking and on their development of a sense of self. And just following up on that, the fifth point is that this relationship with the outside resources allows for the identification of identity content. You know, what's the actual content of an individual's identity, and that this can be put out there and subjected to some sort of moral evaluation and critique. And as I said earlier, a personal identity has a momentum about it. It's relatively fixed, but it can be influenced by new experiences coupled with personal reflection and interpretation, and even by education. It can be affected by perceptions of what others think you are like. Also, it can change in the light of your perception of the identity of others, particularly if they're people who you would see as favoured role models. As we'll see when we look at some of the research theories on identity in the next section, which we'll only look at very briefly, the theory of Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher, is significant because he talks about a narrative sense of identity, that it's like the unfolding life story of the individual. And he sees it primarily as the individual being reflective, thinking about their social interaction, their personal history, as crucial raw material for the construction and ongoing change in identity. However, it may well be that for many people, they don't give serious reflection and thought to their identity and to the cultural meanings and ideas that shape who they think they are and how they express themselves, because they just absorb things and unconsciously and live relatively unself-consciously. That means without a lot of self-reflection. So for some people, the identity might be more something that they display by default rather than something they've given a lot of conscious thought and attention to. Personal identity needs some basic socialization into the beliefs and values and culture of the individual's family and immediate community. And part of that would be access to the key meanings and ideas of their cultural religious heritage. Without that, individuals are not being given the basic human right to the beliefs of their religious tradition as possibly being influential in the shaping of their thinking. What they do with it is going to be their own decision ultimately, but I would advance the view that to be educated, children need to have good access to and familiarity with all of the key meanings of their cultural religious heritage. To be without that is to be uneducated and to be, I think, culturally deprived. A strong sense of personal identity often doesn't mean that you have to defend yourself strongly. If you're so secure, you're usually less defensive. It's often the people who are insecure about themselves that are very touchy and edgy and self-conscious and very defensive. A strong sense of personal identity can therefore be a useful starting point for being open to the ideas and entities of others, because they're not going to threaten you. And this ties in with some of the thinking in Fowler's theory of faith development, that when a person becomes very mature, they are so secure in their sense of self that the boundaries that often set them apart from other people tend to come down, and they can be more open and more involved and more sensitive to others without in any way being threatened by those sorts of interactions, and by being able to dialogue with people who may have very different views, even very different values. So just to conclude, I would say again that one of the things that education is likely to be helpful in will be in helping young people be reflective about identity. And I would also stress again that I think that healthy identity implies some sort of primacy to the inner identity resources, while not neglecting the need for external stuff that we need to express ourselves. And so this shows up in that famous quotation from the play Hamlet, where Polonius gives advice to Laertes, and he says to Laertes, "To thine own self be true. Then it follows, as surely as the day follows the night, that thou shalt not be false to any man." So inner truth, first achieved by knowing one's moral identity and values, and then there is fidelity to those commitments. Well, that kicks off the first piece of work we do on identity, and that will lead us into now the next two sections that look into further aspects of the development of identity and its psychological functions.